You're listening to the cycling podcast at the 2026 Vuelta a España. On the ground and on the road, from Monaco to Granada.
Buenas tardes.
Fran Reyes.
What? This is emotional. This is very emotional. Fran, you only appeared in my midst about 10 minutes ago. You've been here this afternoon, but I feel as though we've got so much to catch up on off mic. But the listeners are going to be treated, I don't know if treated is the right word, but they're going to hear our reunion.
Oh, yeah.
En directo.
Live. Pretty happy to be here with you, Daniel. I mean, for me, it's very exciting, as you say, very emotional to come here also because it's probably the only day that I'm going to be here in La Vuelta for the whole race. Maybe I will come in a weekend, obviously, because it finishes in Granada, which is my hometown. But it's the only day that I come here, and whenever I come to a race like this, in this manner, I feel soaked in love, you know, because there is so much people that you get to know over the years. Some are acquaintances, some are outright friends, and to be hugged so many times by people, to be kissed so many times by people.
Oh,
it's kiss on the cheek, I mean, kiss on the cheek, of course.
Yeah.
It's... It gets me emotional. I feel more and more further apart from cycling as years go on because I grow unattached.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I still feel attached to people and I feel very much attached to the podcast. So
it's great
to be here.
Just hearing you talk about being kissed by everyone, it reminds me that whenever you were on the podcast, the sort of the romance and the sex appeal, it was ratcheted right up. Fran, sexy voice, Reyes. And Fran, of course, and I've sort of forewarned the listeners that at the moment you're working for Kern Pharma. We're going to be talking about them later. Of course, they're in the Vuelta a España. And that is why you're not on the podcast. You're not a regular fixture on the podcast, but you're gracing us with your presence. And Fran, we start the podcast, as we always did, by describing a little bit where we are. It's quite a gritty location tonight. I can see, we're in a bar called El Apetito. Mm-hmm. And next to it is El Rincón Mágico. The magic corner with alternative therapies, and you can have your palm read there, Fran. But how would you describe the setting?
So I think this is like the warehouse of Lorca. Lorca is already a town that it is rather grey in my eyes, but it is lively. There is a lot of population, a strong population here, but this bar is the kind of bar that has trying to renovate itself and failed to create anything appealing. It is named the Appetite, but for me it doesn't grow any appetite.
No.
But on the other hand, mate, this is one of these easygoing terraces that exists in Spain,
yes,
on which you can sit here for the whole afternoon ordering cañas.
Most of the night as well.
Most of the night, into the small hours, ordering cañas, which is the equivalent of 25 centiliters of beer at €1.60, drink. So it's a great place to stay and spend time at, and a great recording place as well, because it's lively around here. And there is so much people from so many different breeds. You really get to mix and understand what this town is about.
It's a very authentic experience tonight, Fran. And you've mentioned Appetite. The bar is called The Appetite. Lest we forget later in the episode, Fran, one thing that Lorca became internationally famous for a few years ago was a football jersey. You've told me that there is a cycling team here who has a similar jersey. Mm-hmm. And why was it famous? Not because Lorca are a great team, I don't know in which division they play, but because the jersey depicted a famous product of Lorca, which is broccoli. The whole design of the jersey was basically broccoli florets.
Yes.
And we've also just remembered that tomorrow we're going to Loja in Andalusia, of course, your home region. And they sort of took inspiration from the Lorca jersey, and their home kit at one point in the last few years was just prawns. Covered in prawns.
This broccoli theme in the Lorca football team was translated into cycling as well. The local cycling club, it has a few competitive teams, both in for men and women, and they are called the Clockwork Broccoli, El Broccoli Mecánico. Okay, and the jersey indeed has broccoli florets all over it. And they had a renowned rider on their ranks, Juan Miguel Mercado, rider from Granada who won two stages in the Tour de France, yeah, a couple of stages in the Vuelta.
A very famous stage of the Tour de France, if I'm not mistaken, in the Jura. It was at the end of the 2004 Tour de France, and it was the stage when Lance Armstrong chased down Filippo Simeone, and he kind of berated him over his testimony in the trial of Michele Ferrari.
Indeed. And then and Juanmi Mercado, he came back to cycling after having going through a rough patch in his personal life. He came back to cycling at age 50, like 3 or 4 years ago, and he did race for a few events with this Clockwork Broccoli.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Fran, that is a lengthy introduction, but I feel it was needed today with the Fran Montada after a significant period away from the cycling podcast. It was required. Anyway, Fran, as we always do, we're going to go back in time to this morning, and we were in Cartagena. The whole of today's stage was in Murcia, if I'm not mistaken, Fran. And in Cartagena, we learned that Mads Pedersen would not take the start of today's 11th stage of the Vuelta. We thought he'd been off colour, not necessarily ill, but the team did communicate this morning that he has, in fact, been battling illness over the last few days. Of course, yesterday he finished last on the stage. I thought he might give it one last go, given that today was the stage that was going to suit him. However, no, Mads Pedersen has pulled out the Vuelta a España. Fran, yesterday, one of Mads Pedersen's teammates, Thibaut Nace, finished on the podium, and well, he was very sort of peppy after the finish and very upbeat about the next few days, so I thought I'd speak to him in Cartagena this morning. And speaking of peppy, we spoke to another rider in Cartagena. That was Primoz Roglic, who gave us another one of his characteristic, enigmatic, mysterious Rogličian an interview is really the wrong word. As I said the other day, it's sort of a kind of in-joke between the interviewer and Roglic, and everyone's in on the joke, and it's just this sort of parlour game. It's not really an interview, it's a parlour game now with Roglic. Anyway, here they are, Thibaut Nace and Primoz Roglic this morning in Cartagena. So Thibaut, I guess you took a lot of confidence from yesterday.
Quite a lot, yes. It's been nice to see a result over there. You know, it's been quite a long time since I fought for the victory, and it feels nice.
Do you think that the only thing that was maybe missing yesterday was a bit more confidence because you haven't been racing a lot recently? You didn't really believe in yourself enough.
Exactly. I think I surprised myself with the power I still had in the sprint after quite a hard final, and I need to keep that in mind for the next days as well. And just have full confidence that, that's just go for it and then maybe risk it all to blow up in the last 100 meters, but still try to win the stage.
And we know about your problems with your knee earlier this year, but is it 100% now? Are you 100% fit, would you say?
Yeah, the knee is all the way perfect. From the moment I start racing in Swiss again, I didn't feel anything anymore, and the knee is 100% okay again.
And last thing then, so Mads not being here, what does that change for you over the next 10 days?
I think it's a bit loss for the team. I think he was still our biggest chance on a stage win, and a big help as well for Matthias in the harder stages. So it's sad to see him leave home, but if the body is not responding the way it should, then I think you need also to listen to that.
And Rimas told us that you are the big rival for him. What do you think about this?
We will see at the end. I mean, I'm not the only one. It's a lot of strong guys. For the moment, I mean, and Eric was the best one. He won last time. It's a long way still to go. We just have to do our best and we see what happens.
And your shape? The grass is forgotten now?
I mean, I still feel it. I still feel my leg when I touch on the places, but... like I said, you know, I'm happy, definitely. I didn't even expect to be on the place that I am. So, we just have to see how I will react on all of these efforts now putting in, you know, and how it will go.
And today maybe a sprint, but tomorrow, mountain, Canal Alto, not bad, no?
We do what is there, no? If it's today mountain, we do today mountain. If it's flat, we do flat. So, will be hard anyway, you know. You saw last flat stage what happened, you know. It's nervous, it's a bit of wind, it's super tricky final, you know. Run in, so, you need to survive.
Primoz, are you thinking differently about the future now, given how well this Welt has gone?
Not really, you know. I just try to be in the moment, be here, you know, today do stage 11, try to calm someone, you know, till 21, and then we see what to do.
El Jamonómetro, de Michele Peranci.
Well, Fran, what a shocker. Primoz Roglic didn't give us any clarity about his future plans or indeed anything else at all.
You can read between the lines. Always read between the lines.
You reckon? I'm not so sure. I will remind you at the start of this Jamonómetro, and I'm going to come to you, Fran, in a minute and ask you how many jamones you give to this stage, that the general classification looked like this morning. Enric Mas led the Vuelta with Roglic second, 118 down. Felix Gal third, 139 down. Only fourth, 220 down. That's as far as I'm going to go. Not jamón, Fran. Mm-hmm. Jamones. How many jamones for today's stage, please?
I feel like Chris yesterday because I am more inclined towards two. Because the quality of the racing that we see usually in these days in cycling demands something else, something more, for this to be a three jamón stage. But, there was this moment with the echelons, there was Lucky Larry out there, so yeah, I think I will stay with the two jamón. Also because the winner wasn't surprising, which makes for a lesser impact.
Two good standard jamones, three El Pozo jamones, because they're such poor quality that you have to account for that. Right, this is what happened, more or less. Stage 11 of the Vuelta would be the last one of the race that would not take place entirely in Andalucía, in a sort of Ruta del Sol writ large. We were starting from an extremely sweaty Cartagena in the extreme southeast of Spain, not far from La Manga, if you're a golf lover. We were heading to Lorca. There was one non-starter, and it was that illustrious name, Mads Pedersen. As was the case yesterday, a group of riders was able to detach itself fairly early. In fact, this time, within the first 10 kilometers, without too much resistance from the main bunch, Ethan Hayter of Sudal, Sinue Fernandez of Burgos Biache, Domen Novak, UAE, and Alessandro Corvi of Jaca Alula made up that quartet. Corvi, of course, had enjoyed success in these parts before, having won the Vuelta a Murcia, a stone's throw from the stage start today in 2022. The gap never got above 2 minutes as the race skirted the Sierra Espuña, a rare green expanse in the beige-baked desert of the Murcian landscape. A routine sprint stage looked to be taking shape until, Fran, with 100 kilometres to go, the pace in the main peloton was ratcheted up, several teams sniffing the possibility of abanicos or crosswinds. The four escapees' advantage duly withered, and splits in the main peloton started occurring. One of the more concerted accelerations came with 88 kilometers to go from EF Education First and Little Trek, piloted by Matthias Skelmoser. Alas for him and then for him and them, more sheltered roads in the town of Fuente Alamo were coming, and order was quickly restored, giving us a grupo compacto with 80 kilometers to go. Apparently, we're all cursed, condemned to the boredom of that status quo for the next 2 hours. But no, Fran, not all superheroes wear capes. And ours was wearing the all-black jersey of Tudor Pro Cycling. Who else, indeed, but the Motown maestro, Larry Warbass, should come to our salvation? Well, Ethan Hayter was the answer. He was with Larry. But who else beyond the Englishman, Fran? The special relationship, the Anglo. Go on.
Sorry?
No, it's okay. The special relationship, the Anglo-American alliance, lasted all the way to the intermediate sprint with 40 kilometres to go, where Hayter took 20 points, Larry 17, and Wout van Aert in the green jersey was third across the line. Unfortunately, it wasn't too long thereafter. Larry and Ethan were mopped up like the sweat from our soaking brows today. Sadly for Larry's countryman, Kevin Vermaeke, he was also involved in a crash just as the peloton accelerated towards the foot of the Alto de Aledo. Vermaeke got up quickly while Hamish McKenzie of Jaca Alula lay on the tarmac, clearly in pain. Happily, McKenzie would finish the stage, albeit in last position. Visma, Lisebike and Cofidis had been pulling all day, but now Pinarello Q30 6.5 moves to the front with Eddie Dunbar apparently poised to attack, or raise the pace at least. It was around this point, with 35 kilometres to go, that Jay Vine sat up from the peloton. Put the family Hacienda on him tomorrow at Calar Alto. The expected Dunbar acceleration came with two kilometres from the summit of the Alto de Aledo, with Wout van Aert doing the job that was Matthew Brennan's yesterday, marking the moves. Dunbar had the wind at his back and his pace was blistering. Indeed, various sprinters were losing touch with the peloton at the back. KOM leader Santi Buitrago looked sure to gobble up maximum points at the top, but Wout van Aert had other and indeed curious ideas, sprinting and adding to his score in the wrong competition. That confused me, Frank.
I was also quite puzzled to see him go for it. I mean, maybe it was just a matter of honor for him, you know, to be first across the climb, but I was surprised.
It was a bit of an odd one. Now, with 30 kilometres to go, we saw a new flurry of attacks with van Aert again playing policeman and enforcing Visma Liesebike's law and order. And pretty much that moment on, all would-be fugitives were kept locked away in the Bruno Almirai penitentiary. Of course, other teams did encroach as the bunch spread into Lodka, UNOX notably colouring the arrowhead of the peloton, a different shade of yellow. But it was van Aert who led into the last U-bend with 400 metres to go. Van Aert who led out of that corner, and Brennan who bolted out of his slipstream with 150 metres to go and went on to win comfortably, raising three fingers like his hat-trick of stage wins as he crossed the line. Fran, let's tell the listeners who came second, third, and so on. Well, it was Brian Coquart of Cofidis, already a stage winner, of course. He was second, never was able to get out of Brennan's slipstream. Jordi Meus of Red Bull Borahansko was third, Magnus Kort fourth, and van Aert himself picking up useful points in sixth, Hofstetter sixth, yesterday's stage winner Tronchon in seventh, Romile of Astana in eighth, Govacar of Bahrain in ninth, and Orluis Aular, who continues to look very isolated without any sort of lead-out train, in tenth for Movistar. On GC, we have no changes at all anywhere near the top of general classification, so what I said earlier still applies. Mass still leads by 118 from Roglic, 139 from Gal, 220 from Only, 326 from Carapaz, and 355 from Skelmos. That's as far as I'll go. In the points competition, van Aert has he extended his lead? Brennan has certainly added to his total. So van Aert leads 174, plays Brennan, his teammates 170. Romelia comes next with 96. In the King of the Mountains competition, no change. Buitrago leads with 31 points from Mass's 24. And in the Young Riders competition, Only leads by 5 minutes and 45 seconds from Jakob Omrazel. Fran.
Wow.
That was
impressive.
A lot to digest there. And we're going to hear from some of the chaps who were involved, as always, or at least masterminding things from the sidelines or in the team car. We're going to hear first from Matthew Brennan's direct sportif, Martin Vinens. Then we're going to hear from the Motown maestro himself, Lucky Larry, who saved us from the boredom today. And then we're going to hear from Eddie Dunbar, who I sort of suggested in that summary was maybe looking to attack, but that wasn't the case at all. He was trying to whittle down the group for his teammate David Gonzalez, who finished
in the top 20, but bottom 20.
Yeah, where was he? Was he about 18? 16th. Pretty lowly 18th. Anyway, 18th. Here they are. So it's Winans, Warbass, and Dunbar. Well, Martin, was that absolute perfection? Was there anything that could have been improved there?
I'm thinking, but I don't think so. That's why. Also, the fact that we were the only team with together with Cofidis that took responsibility, that makes it also really nice. Everybody from the first to the last rider was involved. That also makes it really nice also. Like normal, the sprinters are doing often their job and the climbers are focusing on the climbing stage, but everyone was now involved, so that was really nice. And especially also with the corner, you know, everybody wants to be in front. It was key, and if you almost turn into 1-2-3, yeah, it was perfect then.
And, well, people might say you learned from yesterday, but yesterday was a completely different plan, I suppose, and today was always, the plan was always going to be for Matthew, wasn't it? You didn't change anything because of what happened yesterday.
No, that was the plan, but also, yeah, yesterday was like a split second in the end that it went wrong, but that's also how it sometimes is, because also today was it looks very dominant, but also it could be wrong on a split second just before, of course, but after the setback in brackets, it's a really nice win again for Matthew.
Larry, thanks for saving us from the mid-afternoon torpor with that little breakaway. Ethan Hayter, not an easy wheel to be in, I don't think.
Nah, he's pretty arrow, so I didn't get much draft there. So, I mean, in the end, I don't know, you know, it was like, you never know if you try something in the middle of the stage like that, so... You know, they were they just kept keeping the brake at like 40 seconds the whole day. And so then I was like, well, whatever, let's try something. So I asked a few people if they wanted to go with me and rounded up Leknesund and a guy on Bahrain. And then Peo Bilbao said he'd launch us. So then we tried, and that all that did was everyone got super stressed, and then that pulled the brake back. And then in the end, it was just like no one was doing anything. And I saw Hayter kind of looking around, and I just like gave him a nod, and he saw me out of the corner of his eye. So then he accelerated, and then we went. But we needed more people, you know. So in the end, we didn't really go that hard, actually.
A nice little adventure. You sort of suggested that you were thinking about it for a while. I mean, how does that happen? Is it over, often is it over sort of 5 or 10 kilometers? You think, I might, and then you're looking for the right opening. How does it work?
I mean, it was more just like they kept keeping the brake closer and closer. They were really riding just to like hurt everyone in the bunch. They were just accelerating over the top of every riser and out of every corner and out of every town. And it was just super annoying in the bunch. So then I thought, well, let's give them a taste of their own medicine.
When you do an effort like that, obviously you don't know how long it's going to last, but you know, you'll be looking at tomorrow's stage. A lot of people are thinking about tomorrow's stage. Jay Vine got dropped with 40K to go, probably thinking about tomorrow. Are you thinking by doing this, I am necessarily compromising any chance tomorrow?
I mean, to be honest, once I saw we didn't get any time, I was like, no. Then I was like, let's just not go that hard. So yeah.
I think you're up for anti-doping. So you obviously impressed someone.
Okay. Yeah, I guess.
Well, Eddie, you've tried your best the last couple of days. You've been in the thick of the action in the finale. Just tell us about today's move. Was that something that was talked about this morning in the bus?
Yeah, yesterday David Gonzalez was feeling quite good on the climb, and he's been climbing well this whole race, even despite his crash. And we decided on the bus today, if no one wanted to make it hard on the climb, why don't we try, you know? I mean, it's easy just to sit in a bunch and just ride up there and just wait for a big bun sprint, but you can try and see if you can get rid of any of the other faster guys here. Now, it's always going to be difficult to get rid of the likes of Van Aert and Brennan with the form they're in, but we tried, you know. I'm not sure where David finished up, but we're here to race and we're trying to win, which is a good sign. And hopefully one day it'll just pay off.
What would it have taken for? I mean, what sort of size of bunch were you kind of hoping for to bring into the finale for David to have a good chance there?
I think pretty similar to yesterday. There's like 50, 60 guys, you know, because obviously the faster guys will always have one or two teammates with them as well, you know, on a day like this. And I think in the end it was probably a bit too big. A lot of teams had teammates there, even when we were riding, just to keep the pace high at the front. With 10K to go, a lot of teams came, and it was more like a drag race to the finish. But as I said, it's good signs. Everyone's riding well. Everyone wants to race their bike, which is what we're here to do. And we just continue to do that over the next few days. And as I said, hopefully one day it pays off and we can get a result.
Well, Fran, a bit more light shed on what we saw, particularly in those last couple of hours, with Larry's attack first, then Eddie Dunbar's acceleration on attack, and then, of course, that pretty textbook lead out from Visma Lease Viper. But Fran, on closer inspection, well, you heard me there say to Martin Vinens, it was pretty much perfect, wasn't it? Actually, when I went back and looked and re-watched the finale, then Wout van Aert may have made a little error on the final corner, but it didn't cost him.
Yeah, it didn't cost him, because after all, when you have the legs, the horsepower that they have in this race, I like one thing that I like about Visma, and that singles them out from most teams in the World Tour, is that they always have a plan, or they seemingly always have a plan. They commit to it, and their average level of the team is super high. So putting eight-man roster that is up to the task to battle for stage wins or battle for GC is not that difficult for them. No. And in this Vuelta, in my opinion, they have done really good at identifying their potential targets and going for them. Mm. With Van Aert and Brennan, they can easily go home with 6 stage wins in the back. And today it was their third one, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
So, and I think that it's hard for me to envision a scenario on which Wout doesn't win a stage from here to Granada. Even the stage in Granada itself can suit his abilities.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he certainly looked good when he did sprint for those points. We don't really know what was King of the Mountains points. We don't really know why he sprinted for those points. But he did certainly look as though he's on form in a way that, for example, Mads Pedersen was not. What an asset, Fran, in a Vuelta, but in any stage race, really. But what an asset Almir Haj is. Just on all terrain, really. He's a guy you can sort of repurpose to do anything, really, as a domestique, but also as a breakaway artist in his own right. But there was never any chance of anyone trying anything, really, in those last 15, 20 kilometres with him, mainly ensuring that everything stayed under control.
Yeah, indeed. And they, you know, they have really nailed this mix of the experience of a guy like Almir Haj, of guys like Laporte, Kruijswijk, and they have put with them young guns like Brennan, like Tollet to an extent, like Nordhagen. I think from the point of view of keeping the spirits high, it is a great lineup. They have something to do on every stage. They are landing stage wins, and this is very important in a Grand Tour. In any Grand Tour, but particularly in the Vuelta, because in the Vuelta, one thing that I believe happens, and please correct me if you have a different point of view, is that most of the peloton fades out during the race. You know, they kind of check out midway through the race, and after 2 weeks, there is only 60 riders left in contention.
Yeah, I think there's a very broad spread of motivation levels here, is what I've noticed. I mean, we've already had, I'm not going to name the riders, but we've already had a couple of instances in this Vuelta of riders DNSing, and there have been sort of questions raised about how motivated they were to come here. You know, thinking about riders who are moving teams next year. Incidentally, I'm not referring to Ben Turner. One of the listeners asked us why he pulled out yesterday, and you know, we all know what happened with Finley Tarling in the Volta a Portugal. They were very good friends, and that may—I don't want to make assumptions—but I think it's been hard for all of his. Obviously, it's been extremely hard for all of his family and friends. So that may have played a role there. So I'm not referring to him, but yeah, we do see that always in the Vuelta. And Fran, with as we've got longer and longer contracts in professional cycling, there are fewer and fewer riders who are sort of having to sing for their supper or fight for a contract at the Vuelta a España. Most of the riders here are secure for next year, so that has been a big motivational factor in the past, and that is not there for some riders as well.
Exactly, and also since the seasons are getting longer, more demanding, more absorbing, more energy consuming than ever, at this point of the season, most of the riders just struggle to motivate themselves to prepare for the race and also to stay put, just to stay in the race. If they have already won a race, if they have already earned their oaths somehow, they just don't need the field to keep pushing. And when it's not only individual riders that check out, it's whole teams. Because it's true. At some point, there are teams that just they are no longer in play.
Start dialing it in.
No, yeah, they just... They fall out of the race, you know, and it's a matter of motivation and a matter of energy. The amount of fatigue there is in this point of the season in the peloton and in individual riders is huge. And also, you know, yesterday we had George Bennett pulling out of the race because he needed to be ready for another race further down in the season. What really catches my attention is that there are not many riders available in NSN roster. And I don't think NSN is an isolated case. We also had EF promoting some guy from the development team straight to World Tour, straight to Grand Tours, and performing great.
Yeah, I spoke to Georg Steinhauser this morning. He wasn't originally supposed to do the Vuelta. He did the Tour de France. It was his first Tour de France, and then he was sort of, I don't want to say thrown into the Vuelta at the last minute, but he got a late call up, and he's another rider who's moving teams next year. But he's an example of someone who, if you look at his results throughout his career, and this applies to a lot of riders who have really never performed particularly well after August. It is just fundamentally quite difficult for a lot of riders to maintain, sustain in some cases it's motivation, but in a lot of cases it's just physical freshness, physical condition over 6, 7, 8 months, 9 months of the season.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's a matter of the times, you know, the evolution of cycling is going that way. Seasons tend to be longer. And right now, I believe that teams are start to worry about this, are starting to actually plan for riders to be fresher in the final part of the season, especially if you are in the chase of mandatory invitations for World Tour or for World Tour events in case of pro teams. If you are fighting to avoid relegation in case of World Tour teams, it actually makes sense for riders to take it easy in July or even in August and come out swinging in September and October. You know, the Tour of Guangxi has become an interesting target, and not only for riders who have been sick or ill throughout the season or injury or whatever, also for riders who purposefully plan to be in top shape in this kind of races, because the points that you score there are as valuable as those that you get in the UA Tour, Paris-Nice, EDC, but much easier to attain.
Yeah, the three-year relegation cycle has added an interesting new dimension to the welter in particular. This, of course, is the first of the three-year cycle, so it's relatively, it will seem, the least important. And we also know that in this system, there have been a few tweaks, but in this system, Grand Tour stages are still undervalued compared to the glut of one-day races that there are at this time of year. You know, you think about the Italian, in inverted commas, classics, semi-classics. They're over-indexed, really, according to the UCI point system. But, of course, teams are going to take that into account, and riders will take that into account as well. So, it's an interesting topic, Fran. And maybe it feeds nicely into one of the main things we want to talk to you about today, which, of course, well, your role, first of all. You've been working for Kern Pharma for how long now?
So, last year I was working for Ineos as a press officer. That came to an end at the end of February. And since I have always, well, I have worked, I had worked in the past for Kern Pharma and Lizarte, which was its previous incarnation, for 6 years. I remained very close to the team. And I only had to leave because I have an issue with Kern Pharma, the company that sponsors the team. But since Kern Pharma announced that they were going to quit, to pull out from the sponsorship, they offered me a way back in order to work a bit with the media department, helping handle some particular things, particularly regarding to existing sponsors, and also to assist the management of the team in the hunt for a new sponsor, a new main sponsor for the team.
Okay. So, Fran, the basics that a lot of the listeners will know, they'll remember that Kern Pharma had this incredible Vuelta a España 2 years ago, 2024, where they won three stages in the last 10 days. Yeah. And they might remember as well that Kern Pharma paradoxically didn't do the Vuelta last year because they have this sort of carousel system of the Vuelta where two of the three professional teams get invited.
They rotate.
And last year they were left out. And then the listeners may also have read that Kern Pharma are threatened with extinction, effectively, the team, because they don't currently have, you mentioned Kern Pharma pulling out, they don't currently have a backer for next year. Bring us up to date. What's the situation?
Situation is, we have nothing signed for next year. We don't have a main backer for next season. Back in the month of June, we gave everyone in the team the wild card to find a new job, because we have seen this happening time and again in cycling, which we believe that we can carry on with the team, that we are going to find a backer, but then we delay every deadline up until October 1st. Everyone is waiting for us, for somebody to save the team, and in the end, if no one comes to the rescue, 50, 60, 80 people are left in the street with no jobs for the next year. So we wanted to avoid this at all cost. The phrase that the owner of the team used was, we want this team to survive, but not at anybody's expense. So everyone got a wild card, many riders are already have a home for next year. Many staffers do as well. Some of us are willing to sink along with the ship. We have meetings day in, day out. I send out PDFs with proposals. I draft projects every day on a daily basis. And there is always promising leads, but the harsh reality is that as of now, we don't have a sponsor for next year.
Fran, just tell me if you can't reveal this publicly, but can we talk about how much money roughly is needed to keep the team afloat?
So the average low tier pro team, so the UCI pro team category obviously is the second tier in professional cycling. There are a handful of pro teams that operate on budgets and logistics that are similar to World Tour teams, namely Pinarello, Tudor. Yeah. They are a different category, even if we have the same license.
Cofidis are in that category, Total Energy.
Loro, Intermarché as well on its day. But in our case, the bottom of the pro teams, we operate on budgets around 3 to 4 million euros per season. And then, of course, you can count the money in many different ways. Yeah. You can, depending on how you count the in-kind sponsorship, but the cash needed to run a pro team is at least 3 million euros.
Okay. And obviously, well, you've talked about how many of these sort of, whether it's the pitches, the dossiers you've kind of sending out, and you've given us a rough idea of how many interested parties there have been. But, and I guess it's difficult to generalize, every company, every bit of feedback is different, but how would you sort of characterize, how would you describe what the big stumbling blocks are? Is it purely the money? There aren't many companies with $1 million or $2 million or $3 million in their marketing budget to spend, or is it reservations about cycling? Is it preferring another sport somewhere else to put their money? How would you characterize that?
So on one hand, one thing that really narrows down the field or the pool of potential sponsors is that when you are looking for 3, 4, 5 million euro, you need to find companies that at least have operations for at least 300 million euro per year, you know? And ideally, they must have profits in excess of 20 for it to make sense to commit those many resources into a sponsorship. Then, cycling has a very big, well, some very big USPs. For example, I know it's not the case, unfortunately, in Great Britain, but all over Europe, cycling is broadcasted for free. And it's one of the few sports out there whose top events are broadcasted live, free, and free, and usually in public TVs. This is great for catch all companies, that's to say companies whose target is very wide. For example, banks, insurance companies, they are big on cycling, supermarket chains, they are big on cycling because this is a sport that takes place everywhere in the world, that has huge media coverage, and that reaches a lot of households day in, day out throughout the 6 hot months of the season. But then, in order for a company to commit the resources needed to carry a sponsorship, a cycling team sponsorship, you need to find somebody that believes that investing X million euro during 3 or 4 years makes sense, and then for him or her to talk the whole company on board. When Kern Pharma decided to invest in this team, we were lucky enough for the CEO of the company to be a huge cycling fan who was willing to undergo all this process and spend nearly a year getting everybody on board. But we haven't got that lucky yet.
Yeah.
This time.
Fran, I'm going to ask you one more question about this, then we're going to move on to the Encuentro del Día. But I presume that in your pitch, it sounds as though your pitch is for the team to continue more or less as they are. How much flexibility do you build in, or do you have to build in, to sort of, well, to make the argument to a company or to sell them the idea that we would like to go to the World Tour or we would like to shrink slightly? You know, because they're obviously... there are different levels of professional cycling, different levels of what companies want out of professional cycling, and you can, you have the choice to pitch your team wherever you want, effectively, wherever you think is going to be most successful and going to be most sort of, well, most appealing to a prospective sponsor.
So that's a very good question, and it depends entirely on the sponsor. You know, I mean, there are sponsors for whom we have pitched a team that stays where it is. Companies to which we have spoken about stepping out and trying to find a World Tour ticket eventually, or the mandatory World Tour invitation by being one of the top two or top three pro teams at the end of the season. And then there are another breed of companies that are interested in other type of side projects, or that maybe, for example, something that we have in store and that we really want to put in the road is a women's cycling team. You know, and there are companies that there are companies and investors that didn't care about it, potential sponsors, potential investors that didn't care about this, and there are some others for whom this was the biggest item of attention. You know, so yes, the degree of flexibility
you have to be,
has to be very wide. But on the other hand, mate, I mean, what we can't and we will never do is betraying what we are, you know, betraying the essence of the team. This is a team that was born from a small warehouse in Pamplona in 1993, more or less like Google, you know, from the warehouse, from the garage.
followed similar trajectories.
Exactly, always upwards. But this is a team that has been working in the grassroots of cycling for years and years. This is a team that has always believed in nurturing their own prospects, in helping their riders become their best. I mean, yesterday we had Iñigo Elósegui attacking, trying to go along in the final kilometers and such. And seeing him trying to go for a stage win in La Vuelta in 1996, I could only think of the first time that I spoke with him when he was coming to the team in the winter of 2017. And I was in the Tour of Guangxi, and I was in the hotel, and I was talking to him and on the phone to put together a press release announcing that he was coming. And he was telling me that he was dreaming of sometimes going to Asia because he was huge into... Japanese cartoons and manga and this stuff. And then the following year we went together to the under 23 Giro d'Italia, and he had the worst of the times in the first few days. He was saying, I feel like the lion that goes and marks his territory. Well, the territory that I have marked is the five last spots of the peloton, and I'm going to suffer throughout the race, and it's going to be awful, EDC. And all these nights, we had long conversations with him, you know, telling him that it was not a loss, that that it was part of his development. Well, into the final days of the Giro, he was a completely different rider. Yeah. He was climbing with the best. He was feeling the confidence, the support of the team. 2 weeks later, he was crowned under 23 Spanish national champion, and he had been close for all these years. I have seen him with his struggle, with his problems when he was in Movistar and he couldn't find his feet, and he was struggling to find himself. At the same time, he was going to Japan every winter to make his dream come true. And when he came back to the team, he was far from the riders that everybody had imagined. Everybody was picturing Elósegui as the kind of rider that maybe Jesús Herrada has been, you know, cornerstone in the professional Spanish peloton, fixture that was there in every Tour de France EDC. He came back to the team and he reimagined himself as a supporting rider. We supporting him for him to become this. And now, 3-4 years later, we see him fighting for stage wins and such. This is just an example, you know, but this characterizes the way that we work with riders and the way that we nurture them and the way we believe in them for them to become something special. So this is an essence that we are not never going to betray. You know, we are not going to get 10 million euro and go hunting Kazakh riders for the sake of it. We want to be this kind of team and we want to remain this kind of team. And I believe that this also grows some attachment, because maybe in the international scene it's not such a well-known team, but in Spain people is attached to this team. The media, I can read the media and see that they want the team to survive, and everybody that I have seen today has given me words of encouragement, because they want the team to stay, and this is important as well, you know.
Well, Fran,
sorry for the rant.
I'm going to sound flippant, but behind it there is real sentiment and I hope empathy, because we can hear how much the listeners can hear how much it means to you. But this is the essence of Kenfarmismo, as Palachi, by the term that Palachi coined early in the World Diet Spain. So look, Fran, we've got our fingers crossed for you. We may return to the subject, we may talk about Kenfarma again in part three, but it is time for the Encuentro del Día. From the sublime, what you've just described, Fran, to the slightly ridiculous, I think this is the second equipment malfunction I've had in this Vuelta a España. I said earlier in the race you have one every 300 interviews. I think currently I'm having sort of one every about 50 interviews. Anyway, this morning, Fran, the Encuentro del Día was Peo Bilbao, and my recorder didn't start working until about 40 seconds into the interview. So, if you think that the interview starts slightly strangely, that's why. But hopefully we've got the essence, the kernel of a decent chat, decent encuentro nonetheless. Of course, Peo Bilbao, a real stalwart of the Spanish peloton for many years. One stage in the Giro, one stage in the Tour. He's missing a stage in the Vuelta a España, but he is going to go out at the end of this year. So this is his last Vuelta, and for that reason, I thought he would be not only a suitable but a necessary candidate for the Encuentro del Día. So here I am with Peo Bilbao.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
23, I would say this was my peak, but then I could keep my best numbers, and I'm obviously it's hard for me to win, but I feel I'm still in the front in the races, and I can be an important rider for the team. But no, I prefer to finish it like this with the best feeling possible.
And what are your plans, Peo, for next year, the year after next?
Sabbatic year, no. In the end, I was asking for more time to be with my family, and would be a bit of a contradiction to jump in another project, no? So I just want to be calm at home, take one easy year, and think what I really miss from life, and then prepare next projects.
I'm just going to ask you some quick questions, because we're going to sort of sum up your career a little bit. Your best day as a professional, what was it, do you think?
Best day, I would say Tour de France win.
Yeah. 2023. Best teammate that you've had in all your years as a professional?
Best teammate? Matej Mohoric.
Why?
Because he has everything under control, and he's like he's a super good reference inside the team. He takes a lot of responsibility also in his shoulders. He guides the team, and I really enjoy also racing with him, because it's one of the only riders that are younger than me who can teach me actually quite a lot, no? So yeah, I enjoy being with him.
Last couple of things. Day when you suffered the most on the bike in your career?
Uh, I think it was in the Giro. I don't even remember the year, but I was racing with Asana, Mortirolo stage, snowing in the top and freeze completely, making the descent and arriving to the finish line on the limit. I would say this one.
And then one dream that you haven't fulfilled yet, one thing that you would still like to fulfill.
I don't know. I don't really have right now a dream that I didn't achieve. No, I would say I did more than expected, and I'm more than happy with I got. If I can ask a stage win here in Vuelta, would be great to say goodbye to everyone.
You've got 2 weeks left. So thanks, Pedro. Thank you.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your selection for the US national team. I think you've been asked about it before today. Proud moment?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, the last few years I've done the world, which is really nice, and it's always like an honor to do. But yeah, I would say this is definitely the hardest year to make it because we have a lot of guys going really, really well. And, you know, I mean, I guess they definitely left some guys at home who also deserve to go, especially results-wise. But
Riley Sheehan seems slightly upset on social media.
Did he? I didn't see this. I mean, also his girlfriend's from Montreal, so I can understand why that one like hurts a bit, you know. I mean, also AJ August, like for sure, he also deserved to go. You know, he's been flying. So you know, I mean, I'm under no you know ideas that you know I'm not there for the results that I've gotten. You know, I'm there to help the team, and you know, I guess I'm the most experienced American rider in the peloton now. And yeah, hopefully I can, you know, just really help rally the guys together. And yeah, I think I can do a good job into the final. But you know, that's the thing. It's like we already have a lot of leaders, and so
the thing, Larry, to put it in terms that you would understand, you can't pick 10 wide receivers, can you? You need a linebacker as well,
defensive lineman or something like that. You know, so yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is, yeah, I think they had to bring a well-rounded team, and luckily I fit into that role, which is exciting for me because, yeah, it's honestly, I think it's our best shot at a medal in yeah, very, very long time. So that's really exciting, and hopefully.
Larry, we've got another listener question for you. Following our chat yesterday about how much you enjoy cycling per se, Laura McKenzie, I think Scottsdale, Arizona, jumped ahead in the timeline, way ahead, Larry, way years ahead, and has asked, does Larry have any plans yet for the post-professional cycling life?
I mean, I think I'll probably stay in the sport. So I'd really like to be a coach, but yeah, I'm open to other opportunities. You know, I'd say like, eventually the dream would be to like run a team one day, but for the
together, maybe me and you together, we could go.
Yeah, that'd be cool, you know, you never know. Sponsored by
it wouldn't it be a disaster. It'd be a disaster.
No, it'd be cool, but yeah, we'll see, you know. So I definitely think at least in the near future, post career, post cycling pedaling career, I'd like to stay in the sport and do something there, and then who knows, we'll see.
Stephen Kreiswijk told me a couple of days ago he's going to become a financial advisor to professional cyclists, not an agent, a financial advisor. That's his intention.
Really? Oh, okay, I'll have to ask him. Okay, yeah, that's surprising to me, but that's cool. I mean, that's nice. I don't know, is he going to like do some studies or something or what?
I don't know, we didn't go into that much detail. But it seems, I mean, yesterday I was ribbing you about how much you guys all earn now, and so it seems necessary
for some guys. Yeah. Well, I mean, the other of us, we really need to be smart because we don't have as much to be just blowing around.
You've got those watches.
Yeah, true.
So Fran, that was Larry talking about hopefully a not too impending retirement. Well, we think Larry's going to be around for at least another year because he has a year left with Tudor, of course, but hopefully he's around for many, many years. Fran, of course, this is the interactive part of the podcast. We've got a few
Questions. Eric G asked me this morning, when I think of the Vuelta, I think of FDJ's Salt Bay, aka David Gourdou. Of course, we started calling him Salt Bay a couple of years ago after the, I think, now disgraced Dubai restaurateur, because he was sporting a look that was very similar to the Salt Bay's trademark look. Where is he? He seems to have had a lean year. David Gourdou has become a bit of a, to use a French phrase, cause célèbre in France, and there's been a lot of talk, a lot of teeth gnashing about David Gourdou. The management at Groupama has been pretty critical of him. He became a father a few months ago, and there has been this sort of narrative that he's lost the love, lost the motivation. And if you go and look at his results, he's got a lot of DNFs and he's pulled out of races very early. And yes, so he's not here, and he's not really appeared to be in any sort of fit state to race recently.
Yeah. Also, what I have heard is that he's also in this delusional phase of the decline of some athletes, on which he still believes he's as strong as he was, but he just doesn't show.
No, certainly not. Certainly not so far. We got a good question, Fran, from Jono Jono. Yesterday we had Leonard Snooks of You Know X, and we talked with him about the Norwegian sort of identity of that team and how that team really gels together and everyone sort of gels together, and how the Norwegian-Danish identity and the fact that they only draw riders from those countries has been a force for good in that team, and it's helped them. Jono Jono asks, well, he says, some Australian commentators have seen Uno X's rise and Jayco's demise as evidence that committing to a national identity and not diluting it is the key to success. Thoughts? Question mark. This is an interesting question in relation to Jayco Alula, because this has been a topic of conversation, or something that they themselves and people in the team think a lot about. Have they gone away? Have they strayed slightly from the very Australian identity that they had at the origin of that team? It wasn't just the riders, it wasn't just the composition of the team, but it was things like the team song and various other things in terms of, well, how they projected their identity publicly. Of course, in the last few years, they've taken on quite a lot of Italian riders. They've always had a bit of an Italian heart, in the sense that the service course is in Varese, but I've heard terms like the lamprification of Jayco being used.
Lamprification.
Yeah. And I have heard sort of anecdotally this year that there has been a bit of a lurch back towards the origins of that team and what was the original identity of that team, and that's been seen as a good thing, particularly that, you know, they had some success at the Tour de France, and that was something that I heard, that the team is feeling more like it used to feel at this point. But Fran, what do you think about this? It's an interesting question, isn't it? Because we've had many teams over the years that have been almost de facto national teams, and they've really embraced a national identity, whether it was Rabobank, Sky, or on a smaller level, maybe teams like Kern, or even regional identities. I just mentioned Groupama yesterday. We talked about the fact that they've become even more French again this year, it seems like, anyway, based on the roster. What do you think about this?
I think that it's very important that team culture is an asset, that it is very hard to evaluate from the outside, but it is key for a team success. I mean, and the team culture, it is easy for it to be positive and good for the running of the team if there are no cultural barriers between the members. Of course, it never hurts to throw diversity into the team, but you need to find the right profiles. I think that one team that does this great is EF. EF, they, in the terms of nations, they have a very diverse array of riders.
And I think the sponsor wants that, because of course the sponsor's business is international language schools.
Yet they manage, I believe, to find the right profiles to put into the mix, you know, rather than hunting people for the sake of their watts, of how many watts can they push. They try to scout also the personal profile, and I think that's pretty, pretty important.
Yeah. Fran, final question of the interactive part of the podcast. This is just my question to you. Since we're talking about this, it's an interesting subject as it pertains to Movistar, because Movistar is a team that's tried desperately to internationalize. Now, at this Vuelta a España, with Kian Uttabrooks gone, I think all of their riders are Spanish. They've got the sort of OGs in the team car, or they've got two individual, Chente, García Costa, and then they've got José Joaquín Rojas. They're both dyed-in-the-wool Movistar men. I mean, this is really an excuse for me to ask you generally about Enric Mas's Vuelta and how you see it going from this point. But it is maybe a sort of subplot or something worth noting about them at this Vuelta, that it is very, very Spanish.
Yep. The Movistar, over the last 2 years, they have managed to assemble a good squad of Spanish talented riders. Mm. You know, this for the last few years, we had seen some of the brightest Spanish talents not go to Movistar and choose international teams instead. I mean, there are the remarkable examples of Carlos Rodriguez, Juan Ayuso, Héctor Álvarez, who is at the Little Track Development team, and next year is going to be one of the main names in the World Tour because he's going to be amazing from day one. There is Adria Pericas, there is Benjamin Noval. All of them chose not to go to Movistar, even when they had propositions on the table. In the last 2-3 years, though, they have managed to sort of turn the tables, and they have recruited riders who maybe are a bit older. Some of them came from Kern Pharma, some of them were raised in Caja Rural or in Kern Pharma itself, and after going through different teams, landed in Movistar. And in this year, what they have done is they have put Pablo Castrillo, Raúl García Pierna, Iván Romeo, all these riders that are here in this world, they have raced together in the Dauphiné. They raced together in some other race in the spring that I can't put my finger on, so I won't name it, but there was another one. They went to the Tour, or they were set to go to the Tour together, and now they are at the Vuelta together. They have gelled together. Again, this creates a culture. This creates an environment on which riders and people thrive, and everyone is more motivated, from the staffer to the bus driver to the DS, on to the rider himself. And this positive culture has been pretty good also for Enric Mas, because Enric, he has been on the spotlight for so many years, being the big Spanish hope for the Tour de France, which is a race that maybe is just not the best for his skills. And what I felt the other day when I saw him in Antana taking the win is that this win in the red jersey was sort of the reward, the payback for so many years of struggles, of being laughed at, of being despised, of being considered a joke of a GC leader. Now it's all coming back to him. To Movistar too, because Movistar, they, in my modest opinion, there are a lot of things that they may do wrong, but there are also a huge amount of things that they do right. And they have fell to the bottom half of the World Tour because of a matter of budget. Basically, it's the main reason. There is also the supporting project. We can say as many, we can put as many caveats as we want, but they are rowing against the current. And this season in particular, they were struggling to get things right. And then, in the best possible scenery for them, which is the Vuelta, huge race for the team, for the riders, they have managed to win, to get probably their best victory since Alejandro Valverde won the Worlds, maybe, you know?
Yeah. Well, big day for them tomorrow, of course, Fran. We're going to talk about it now. We are going to talk about tomorrow's 12th stage, the Cala Alto.
La etapa de mañana y asuntos varios. Tomorrow's stage and any other business.
Well, Fran, let's talk first, shall we, about tomorrow's stage quickly, because we've had a long chat, I think. Hopefully the listeners would have enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Sorry, first, we were talking about Movistar, and Enric Mas wants the Spaniards, the Andalusians, to turn out in force tomorrow. He says que los aficionados pongan estufas, which worried me, Fran, because literally it sort of means they sort of start fires, which given what's been happening, over the last few months in Spain and elsewhere. It doesn't sound like a very good idea, good or sensible idea, but I think he means he wants a hot atmosphere from the Spanish fans.
Yeah, there was also, you know, there has been this running joke for 10 years in Spanish cycling amongst pro riders, which is bring some blankets whenever they are training or racing in hot temperatures. They yell this, traed mantas, bring blankets. Ah. So maybe this has something to do with that as well.
curious. Fran, Calar Alto, of course, last featured in 2017 with Superman Lopez winning. I've already tipped Jay Vine to win tomorrow in the breakaway. Not much else to say, really, apart from the fact it's a beautiful climb. The Velafica is a beautiful climb as well, the one before. Sometimes the Velafica has been the last climb that they've done. Damiano Caruso won the last time up there. But yes, we won't go into too much detail about the stage. Needless to say, it's one of the biggest stages in the world. It's a big summit finish, very long final climb, very irregular Calar Alto, and it should be a rip snorter, as they say in English, Fran. Also, look out as well for the telescope, the observatory on the top. Lots of planets have been discovered with the telescopes up there. I think it's the biggest telescope in continental Europe. So, I'm not sure how much that will add to your viewing experience, but bear it in mind. Fran, we usually talk about yesterday's dinner. Yesterday's dinner was nothing to write home about except the wine, Fran. We had a Jumilla. We're in Jumilla country, a Pinot d'Onfel.
Red wine.
Yeah, very thick, sort of tannic, grown-up wine. The sort of wine you kind of need a spoon to drink or a fork to drink even. It was beautiful. But Fran, last night I made a very controversial statement about Spanish food. The mid-tier of Spanish food, I find it disappointing. And last night bore that out because we stayed in a nice place, but I had pechuga and chips, chicken and chips. And one thing I love about the Spaniards, and don't take this the wrong way, is I find the Spaniards very humble, generally. And this is one of the really nice characteristics about the Spaniards. But I find their cuisine quite humble as well, in the middle tier.
And I agree with you. And it's only now that we've seen, I mean, as the deluxe restaurants get more and more expensive, there is a mid-tier that is rising. But maybe not in small towns, but in big towns.
Not El Apetito.
Not El Apetito. El Apetito is not mid-tier, you know? But you can find many mid-tier restaurants in mid-sized cities and big cities. It's going to become better. And I will give you, if you happen to sleep in Granada in the coming days or at the end of the Vuelta, I will give you some addresses on which you will find decent dinners for a decent price, and that will satisfy your appetite.
I don't doubt that. Fran, well, hopefully, and I know this is true, you have satisfied the listeners' appetite for the Fran Montada. We've had a clamour for it, so people will be very glad to hear you back. And well, thank you very much. And it's really, really good to see you, and all the best of luck with the search for a sponsor.
Thank you very much. We will do our best. We are going to keep working. And it's been great to sit down with you and record this podcast.
Thank you, Fran.
Thank you, listeners.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.